Hi, fellow geochemists and geochemistry enthusiasts. Welcome to Geochemist Tea, the only podcast for people who love geochemistry with a side of tea. Our mission is to inspire aspiring geochemists and to introduce our listeners to niche geochemistry topics. I'm your host, Sam Schur, and this month we're talking with Ben Chai about method selection. Ben is the owner at Fractal Geoanalytics. Ben, welcome to Geochemistry.
Hello.
Ben reached out to our illustrious podcast to see if we were interested in doing an episode on the selection and application of sensors for exploration and mining. So Ben, I can't tell you how often people request this topic. So it was really exciting getting a subject matter expert to talk to us about it, because usually it's just me prattling on about it and everybody just agreeing with me. So it's nice to have somebody here to talk to about this.
I'm going to disagree with everything.
I love it. Looking at your career history, Ben, I find it fascinating that you worked for BHP as both a geochemist and a geophysicist before becoming their principal data scientist. How does this even happen? So just talk to us about this.
Before I was even a geochemist or a geophysicist, I was a lowly mine geologist at Yarri, which was actually quite an amazing mine because it's one, it's iron ore, and iron ore is the best commodity, by the way.
Okay, this is where we're going to start to have our issue, but anyway, continue.
Yeah, no, iron ore is the best commodity, bar none. Anyway, apart from iron ore being the best commodity and definitely better than gold, Yarri was a great mine because it was really small by way of iron ore. It was tiny. It might have been an 8 million ton per annum ore mine. But basically, Yarri was really good because I learned a lot of stuff from a lot of people. And that was everybody from the blast crew to the digger operators and the truck drivers and the drill and blast team. A lot of the time I'd spend out there digging up samples and chucking them into buckets and whatever else, and learn a lot about sampling, mostly by doing it wrong. It's actually really important to do things wrong to learn how to do them right. And just generally because of the time I started, it was really good. There wasn't necessarily a whole heap of time pressures. So as long as you were getting what you needed to do done, it was all good and you could learn anything you wanted. So in all that spare time, I learned as much as I could around sampling theory and QAQC and assaying and whatever else. And that was awesome. I loved it. It was actually great. And then after that, I managed to score somehow a role in the Brownfields Exploration Department, which was also really educational. But just going into mining was a really, because one, it was not what I wanted to do. Going into mining was very educational because you really learn about time pressure and production. And I'd sit on railing morning meeting and then the mining production meeting, and you just had an understanding that everything was running on a schedule. You were there to grease the wheels of production, basically, as a geologist. And I didn't really love it. The graduate liaison guy, I pestered his little ears off and eventually managed to get a transfer when the next grad came in to the exploration department, and then went off and did QAQC and RC and Diamond. And that was also really amazingly educational because we went to a totally new part of the Pilbara, different iron ore deposits, drilled a lot of meters. I don't think anyone really understands the absolute mega scale that iron ore is done at. If you've never been to Australia, iron ore is really big, not in terms of every pit's gigantic, but just, I think I was responsible for 3 rigs at a time, maybe 4 or 5 at a pinch across a very large area. So we had maybe 10 Ks between rigs, and you go do your morning pre-start inspection, you do the safety sign-offs, you do all everything, you did everything. You pestered them about QAQC and sample quality and drilling wet and drilling dry and inserting your standards and logging stuff. And yeah, it was very good. With all my amazing knowledge of QAQC and a bit of R that I learned in mining, I managed to befriend the geochemists, and they were working on a super secret project at the time, and somehow I managed to convince them that I was really good at QAQC and I'd be great to do the field work for the project. So they moved me into Perth, into that team, and I started off then as a geochemist doing QAQC and sampling, and learned a lot, I guess, about signal processing at that stage, and way more, I think, than I ever wanted to do. Before going too far down this story, I want to actually recount an interesting tale. When I was at uni...
My tea before the tea.
Yeah, but it's not even the tea. This is just, I really like this story. I don't know if you know the Falcon. There's a system called the Falcon, airborne gradiometer. Yep, Falcon's great. I interviewed for a job at Rio Tinto, and they basically said, do you want the job? And they actually said, nah, don't. I'm good. And then they said, why is that? And I said, oh, look, I really wanted to work for BHP. And they go, why is that? And I said, I really like the Falcon. I just thought that was just a really cool piece of technology. So I went, oh, yeah, I really want to work for BHP because they've got the Falcon. They seem like a company who does technology. Anyway, the lead of that project, Arthur Madhava, was the lead of the Falcon project as well. So I always try and get the actual real expert I talked about was Arthur, and I've been trying to convince him to come onto a podcast for years because he has some amazing stories. So Arthur, you better be listening, and also you better be on a podcast because he would be amazing to get. Anyway, Arthur basically taught me everything I knew about physics, which was far more physics, I think, than I ever intended to know, and signal processing as well. So very, very low level, you know, you receive your spectra raw and then you need to turn it into something usable. So that's really where I started off doing spectral, very low level. And so he put me on a good path and he wrote a whole heap of code that was used. Then I took it over from him, rewrote a lot of it, put it into production, and yeah, so that was how I became a geochemist and how I led into my next role as a geophysicist. So my boss changed from a geochemist to a geophysicist, and her boss's boss said, you can't be a geochemist working for a geophysicist, so Ben, now you're a geophysicist. And I said, well, I don't really care what you call me, you could call me garbage collector as long as you pay me. So then I became, a geophysicist. I did learn a lot about geophysics, spending all the time with the geophysicists and sitting in on their meetings. So I did also a lot of stuff on just downhole wireline tools, so MagSus, density, gamma, natural gamma. We did a lot of early trials for the DOG, downhole driller operated gamma, and other things like that. So we were very early on for a lot of projects with R. And at that point, I was a geophysicist because my boss was a geophysicist, which was cool. And then after a lot of pestering of my boss and showing that I knew what I was doing, I managed to get a new job title called Principal Data Scientist. In my defense, I am probably much better than the average geologist at data science. So I do know how to use a convolutional neural network, and you can't trick me if you say things like XGBoost and CatBoost like that, because I know what all those things are. So was a principal data scientist. We still did a lot of R&D at the time. So we did a little project with Southern Innovation called the Drill Scan. Basically, it was for real-time measurement of RC chips, the spoil pile from an RC rig to give a real-time FE grade. So we did that. And just other things like hyperspectral and MWD and whatever else. And people would come and try sell us things, and we'd decide whether we wanted to buy them, and we'd set up test plans and whatever else. Yeah, that was my, I guess, story as a geologist to a principal data scientist. Yeah.
So what made you leave the big orange machine then? It sounded like you were in paradise.
Oh, at some point it was always time to move on. The beating heart of doom.
Oh my god. So that said, you had a pretty interesting career in this sense. Could you have any advice for our listeners?
The older I get, the more I believe in The Secret. So
in which secret is that?
the book The Secret, Oprah Winfrey's favorite book. Yeah, The Secret. If you want something, you just believe that the universe will send it to you and it will come. That's basically how the universe works. So if you want to be a geochemist, you just decide you're going to be a geochemist and you're just going to do geochemistry. There's no rules. No one's going to stop you from looking at the assays. No one's going to say, hold on, Bob, you are a geologist. How dare you? How dare you open up IOGAS? you know? How dare
especially
you
especially when nobody else is opening a biogas.
Yeah, yeah. How dare you open that up? How dare you use Python to read that CSV file and do something productively? There is absolutely nothing stopping you from doing whatever it is that you want to do. I shit post on the internet and write what I want, and no one really stops me yet. So I feel like I can do it some more.
Yeah, I guess I do that too. But that's an interesting piece of advice that I don't think we've heard before. Recommending people to read Oprah's book club now? Is that where I've gone?
Yeah. Now we're in the book club. Okay. So yeah, we're in the book club. We're in the book club. We're reading stuff.
I don't know if I have to pay a trademark for that or something, but yeah. All right.
I've never actually read The Secret. I think if you read the blurb and it says, if you want something, you just think about getting it and it comes to you. I feel like that's all you need. And the rest of it is just examples.
The rest is if you're just in the pits. All right. So if anybody reads The Secret, let us know. But otherwise, just go with the back blurb and just manifest. Yeah, exactly. Hit us up. Send us a note on LinkedIn.
Yeah, damn straight.
So now that we've heard about your journey where you've changed careers, really, not just job titles so often, I'm just wondering at this point, what more do you have to share with us? Now is my favorite segment. It is tea time, kettle's hot. Let's hear what you got.
Okay, look. I don't know if I'm a gossiper, but whatever, why not? Everybody knows that all bodies getting worse and worse. Basically, the grades going down, everything about them sucks. It's just hard work. If I was to give any career advice to anyone, it would basically be, you want to be a GMET. Because when stuff is getting really hard to process, I feel like that's where it's going to be. And everybody talks about all body knowledge. Knowledge is power. I'd prefer if people talked about all body power, because it just sounds so much better. But yeah, it's really geometallurgy. And it is that intersection between where you are a geologist, what they're putting in the plant, and what you're expecting to get out. And I feel like if you're looking at all the core scanning providers and all the downhole tools, we really, to be a geomet, you're moving away from just assay, right? There's that complexity that everyone talks about, and it's the interaction between, I've got some assays and they represent really just a set of minerals in a rock mass. Obviously everybody loves assays, everybody loves minerals. It's really hard to get minerals from assays, so sometimes you have to use something like hyperspectral, and it is that clarity. So apart from that one note, I just want to say the other thing is that, again, spectral data is just super underutilized within the industry in itself. So a lot of people will collect the data, and I don't know, Sam, you work for CoreScan, you probably scanned a lot of core, did a lot of work for people, threw it over the fence, and then what happened? Who knows? I don't know if they ever looked at it again. No idea.
I've made a second career out of working with different providers, clients, to try and implement it in ways that are meaningful, because you are correct. It's such an overwhelming data set. I remember I had a mentor of mine to actually whom this podcast is dedicated. And he said to me when we were sitting down in a pub, he says to me, "Why are you working for spectral? People don't even use assay." And I was like, "You're not wrong." He said, "We got to get them to use assay first." And I was like, "Let's just try them to do both." Yeah, it's very hard. People just are very data adverse in general because it's hard and they have so many things to do in their day job, like drive back and forth to 10-kilometer space drill rigs to do inspections, that they're like, where's the time in my day for me to look at a new data? So I don't disagree with you about GeoMet being a really good place for people to be in terms of a career path. I find a lot of the geochem style work that I do is now, a lot of it for many years now has been focused on more of the geomet side. And I know a lot of other geochemists too, that more instead of the classic kind of applied geochemistry exploration, they more so now focus on geomet. So there are proper geomets as like a very great job direction, but then also a little bit of us in geochemistry, some of us trend towards geomet as well. So yeah, that's pretty good advice.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm just actually rereading all my notes and just realized that I didn't actually say any of the things that I've noted. So it was a pointless exercise, really, wasn't it?
Anything else you want to say to us?
I don't know if I should go. I feel all right. I don't know whether I should go back and talk about it, but should I, will you just edit this and make it sound like I was really smart and coherent the whole way, or is this just going to be just rambling?
I could do some editing. Yeah, oh, I could try. Or I could just be like, you know what, it's funnier for this to just continue how it is and just leave it unedited.
Yeah, no, let's do it that way. It's way hilarious. People will be sitting
in a car driving. So you haven't read your notes.
No, I just write them. I don't read them. Yeah. People are going to be driving around in their car for 10 kilometers between rigs and listening to this.
Exactly. That's why the extra 5 minutes. Somebody told me, oh, podcast max 40 minutes. And then I have ones that sometimes are an hour and a half long. And there were people like you that would drive 10 kilometers, 10 kilometers, 10 kilometers to all these different rigs. So anyway, go ahead. Tell us. What more is on your mind?
Okay. And the last piece of advice that was on my notes, it was related back to my secret comment. So anyway, it was back. I was on an interview panel. I was an interview panel for a job, and they said, what does it take to be good at what I did, which was like a neutron spectroscopist? And I said, look, my only answer is you just have unreasonable self-belief. I am a geologist, and I have absolutely no real skill in math, but yet here I am doing far more math than I ever thought, and I basically failed it. I've almost basically failed physics, and here I am doing physics. If you want it, you just make it happen. Also, you should publish a whole heap of stuff, because when you leave wherever it is that you've been for 13 years, like I was at BHP, and you want to go out on your own, it's very useful to have sort of a body of work that you can point to say that you're actually really good. Yeah, I didn't really do that because I was just too busy doing stuff, and I was quite, hindsight 2020. Yeah, really publish. So I'm making up for my 13 years of not publishing by annoying people on the internet, which clearly is just as good.
I find that people sometimes like to be annoyed on the internet. It breaks up their day. I did quite a lot of conferences, which helped get my name out there. Some of those have long abstracts, so those are a little bit of kind of publication style. But it is useful to try and tie people back and be like, oh, okay, I saw you there. So even just doing a conference at a job, you won't necessarily allow to go on completely on the conference circuit, because to be on the conference circuit as a BD person would be, it involves 80% of your life, which is just too much for a normal job. But otherwise, if you pick one or two conferences a year and you're able to give talks at them, then that's a really good way to get at your name too. Another recommendation.
Hot tips here.
Hot tips. That's what this is. It's not tease the hot tips line. Right. We've devolved. Okay. So back to our geochemistry topic. For this episode, we looked at the New Elements Journal, which has a really great geomet theme to it this month. And this paper was entitled Characterization of Ore Properties for Geometallurgy by Butcher et al. 2023. And while this was a great read, this was more so just for get us into the headspace of applications of sensor or methods and the technology. Could you just sum up the paper in this context to get us all ready to dive into this topic of method or sensor selection in the exploration and mining industries?
Yep. It's a very new paper. Really, the biggest thing around it is just to introduce you to what is available, because there is a lot of stuff available, and I don't think that paper actually has absolutely everything possibly that you could use, because that's actually a lot of work. One of my favorite things that I ever saw was Rio Tinto did a bit of work, and I can't remember who it was, with some university, but basically they got all these sulfide samples, because you can't detect sulfides or you can't discriminate them with hyperspectral, and they ran them all through a microwave and got them hot, and then they scanned them with a thermal infrared camera.
Okay.
And you could discriminate between like chalcopyrite and bornite and all these types of things, because they all have different heating rates. That particular technique, for example, was not in there, which was quite sad because I really liked it. Or it doesn't have things like MR, magnetic resonance, or a whole heap of other stuff, but it is definitely good coverage of your options, at least initially anyway. But if I was to pick fault, it didn't really go into why you choose one over the other. And I think that's actually quite important, because a lot of people say, I've got some core. Should I scan it? What should I scan it with? In WA,
or everybody else is scanning, yeah. So I must be scanning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If your friend jumped off a cliff with a piece of drill core to a scanner, would you do it too? Yes, you would. So in WA, there's a program called the EIS, or the Exploration Incentive Scheme. A lot of people do get their core scanned by the state survey, so they basically get Hilogger, I think, effectively for free. So that's always a bit of a no-brainer in WA. Anywhere else where you're paying, I feel like this is an important detail to note. Like, why would you choose hyperspectral imaging over, say, point hyperspectral over I'm just walking around with an ASD, or I'm doing hyperspectral on pulps, just to really offend as many people as possible?
I was going to say you've offended me there, but continue.
I can. How much do you want me to offend you on my whole hyperspectral with pulps line?
Maybe just because people might not know, why wouldn't you do hyperspectral on pulps?
If you had a hyperspectral imager and you just stuck all your pulps into a chip tray and scanned them, that's stupid. Don't do that. Because basically every single pixel of that tray is exactly the same as any other pixel of the tray, of the sample. The reason why you should do it is, and also all your feature depths change and everything changes, and clearly you can't use that. That is useless information, one would think, because it's not from a real piece of core or from some crushed material. However, Sam, the most important reason why you do it on pulps is because you don't collect hyperspectral for fun. You actually collect it for a business process and a business reason, and that reason generally is to predict some physical property across a wider selection of your ore body than your very small amount of diamond core that you're doing for met testing.
You would do it on the coarse reject.
But that's how representative is your coarse reject?
It's just what you got to think about is the pixel size is a big problem. So if you're thinking about pixel size and your pulp material, whatever it's at, 80 micron, 63 micron, whatever, it's tiny. So that versus, say, 500 micron by 500 micron square, it's just disproportionate. Whereas if you go with the crush material, at least then you're getting more representative sample. And you can then also have in there the different parameters, and those would work as well. So that's why I would do crush material.
Yeah, that's definitely why you do it. But I don't know. This is maybe the iron ore geologist in me talking.
Okay. Tell me from an iron ore perspective.
We're looking at hundreds of thousands of samples, right?
Indeed.
So you are absolutely not interested in core scanning all of those. Or you don't want an image. You do not want an image. You just want a spectrum. You want it the best possible quality spectrum you can achieve. And one of the things, but particularly between RC and diamond, is that the RC top size does actually vary quite a lot as you drill for a given interval, whereas if you chuck some diamond core through a crusher, it's relatively consistent. But all that variation, when you go to model your physical property, let's say lump and fines from your diamond core to the rest of your ore body, it actually doesn't work because your hyperspectral is just too different across those two data sets. So you need to take out all the variation you can in those two systems. So therefore, you reduce your top size down to pulps. And then plus you get to use FTIR. But even if you don't, you still just get a better progression model.
Yeah, and I think with that, it's really important. And what I always start out with, whether it's talk or whether it's with a client, is just you got to start out with what the objective of your study is. And then you got to see if the tech is right for you and then how you set up your actual study. So to your point with iron ore and how they're just such huge beasts, and iron ore mine, we're not scanning everything. We're not taking a point of everything, right? We're creating a very constrained study, but it's no different if you're doing, say, a porphyry. Those are pretty large systems too. So are we going to scan the entire core library of years of core? No. So how do we set that up? What are the different cross sections that we want or that we need? So it's
just send them all to the lab and get your hyperspectral on pulse and eliminate as much variation as possible in your modeling process. Whether it's TerraSpect or FTR doesn't really matter because it's the same sort of principle. You just eliminate that variation. Unfortunately, I know I've looked for a really good data set that shows this. Unfortunately, I don't think there is one. There was one paper by Dewey et al., but that's not actually really the example I want because they grind, they start off with a bit of core and then they cut it and then they grind it down to various levels of roughness and then keep rescanning it. And then they pulverize that section and then say, look, you know, we've obliterated all the textures and our feature depths are less. Yes, but that's not, yeah, that's not normally what would happen in an operation. So, and then there is a little bit of commentary around how you particularly extract those features. So if you're using something like simple systems, like just give me the minima of this feature versus polynomial fitting or Gaussian decomposition, which is totally something else. But for this example, we're just going to say I'm fitting a series of Gaussians to that feature depth. So there's a lot of ways how you can get around that loss. But again, the really good data sets, I don't think anybody has made available. And I do know they exist, but yeah.
And I think an interesting thing that we're talking about here too is that what a high level, what people know for, say, spectral companies is that, okay, we're going to do a mineral interpretation for you. So then you're presented with minerals, but there's a whole nother stream of science that's just working with just the data cube and just working with the spectral curves. And I think that's more of what you're talking about. So just for everybody out there to know, it doesn't just have to be, here's your mineralogy. Look at how interesting all this is downhole, which inherently makes more sense to a geologist, I mean, which is great. But there is another whole way that people can treat this data set, which has just as much validity as presenting.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, there's a lot. And it's such a deep subject that probably...
It's so deep.
I could waste an hour and a half on this conversation itself.
One of the things that you pointed out for your paper selection was that this paper doesn't address why you would pick one sensor over another. So starting out slow here, maybe, I think it's slow. Could you just outline the general classes of sensors and why you would select one class over another? Do you need a coffee?
No,
a beer? Is it late there? Yeah.
It is late here, but it's water time. In terms of classes of sensors, the easiest way is to say I've got an elemental method like XRF or neutron activation. I've got a mineralogical method with hyperspectral or Raman, or I've just got RGB photos or other weird kind of more physics-based sensors like natural gamma or MagSus. So those are the classes, but really you choose your sensor for your business case, right? So you say, if I want to know, and the example I'm going to run with is just, let's detect some magnetite in a granite, because that's so straightforward. We can start from nothing there, right? So let's just imagine this is our scenario. We've got magnetite in a granite. Let's call it a porphyry. I don't know anything about porphyries. They're just big white things and boring.
That could have magnetite in it. I love it.
That,
continue.
That could have magnetite in it, so it's already going well. Let's say it's really important to know magnetite because I want to know the oxidation state, and it's important to know whether I've got, say, hematite or magnetite, whatever. So let's say let's go from zero. How would you do it if you were just logging a call? You'd look at it and say, oh, I think that's magnetite, right? It's very difficult to quantify exactly how much magnetite you have or how much of anything you have, right? And that's fine if you're just wanting to say, I've got presence or absence of a particular mineral. But let's imagine we want to step it up a notch and do something slightly better. We'll pull out our magnet and drag it along the core and just look for that sort of magnetic pull as we drag the magnet along. And maybe that's better than just logging something by eye. But this is the sort of thing that we can improve on. So we've got step zero is just I'm logging what by eye. Step two, I've got a tool. I've got a magnet. I want to kick up the performance of my magnet. I'm going to get a bigger magnet because you should always have a bigger magnet. It's very important. And then you're just swinging bigger and bigger magnets across your core.
Good
to really
God, what kind of porphyry are you working in? I don't know,
one with bigger magnets. Yeah, really huge neodymium magnet. But
oh my
you do
God.
Get the gist is that you can actually increase the performance of your sensor system by just putting more power into it. And that generally works. So let's say now we want to quantify more or less the volume of magnetite we have. So let's go to a MagSus sensor. Let's put a KT10 in the system. Maybe that's good enough. You don't need, as a geologist, or your business does not need to know any better than a KT10. What a KT10 can provide. So is that good enough? I don't know. And this really is the whole business value. Do you need to know better than handheld MagSus? like with the magnet system, logging by eye, and the KT10, that whole depth registration issue comes up on really deep holes. There's always that little bit of loss and gain, and you're never really sure. If that depth problem is very important to you, the next logical step up is just to go with a wireline MagSus tool. Obviously, then you're pulling in a second contractor. They're coming in with a truck and a whole heap of tools and safety issues and whatever else, but they will give you a MagSus measurement and they will be able to tell you exactly the depth, right? Because that's one of the great things of wireline, is just knowing exactly where stuff's located down the hole. There's also some other advantages with having, I guess, certain measurement geometries. So that tool is actually surrounded by your rock mass. So you have something that you can really sense. You're measuring everything around you. So you have a little bit of a boost in sensitivity, or probably should. And maybe that's good enough, right? The other thing really good about downhole wireline tools is they give you that 10 centimeter increment of logging. And my gut feel is that 10 centimeters is more than enough for anyone. You shouldn't need more than 10 centimeter of downhole precision. That's just, anything more than that's overkill.
Yeah, especially considering maybe your block size in a porphyry versus an iron ore. That's a good tip for all of you.
Yeah, block size.
10 centimeter versus...
A 10 by 10.
What is the resolution that you need?
Yeah, what's the resolution that you need for the decision that you're making? And it's really, and that answer is going to change over time, right? If you're just vectoring, and it is important to know your oxidation state, vectoring might not have really high performance tolerances. So just knowing that it's there is good enough. If that magnetite is associated with a different type of metallurgical or processing parameter with your rock mass, then you really want to know how much magnetite you have and really quantify that, because some of these things just really have some extremely strong proxy measurement that works really well. Again, I just made up this scenario. It's not even real. Once we've moved past downhole tools, we can then say, what about handheld spectral instruments? So obviously you've got LIBS, very popular, handheld XRF and hyperspectral of whatever flavor you like, really. This is where, again, probably could waste another hour and a half talking about spot sizes, but spot size is actually very important for this. If you've got tiny little magnetite grains and you've got a 8 mil or so spot size, how likely is it that some of these handheld spectroscopes will pick up that magnetite? And this is where it's hyperspectral, a bit of intimate mixing, LIBS, just whether you've actually touched it with your spot. XRF is a bit interesting because, of course, magnetite being Fe304 and hematite being Fe203, you can't necessarily tell whether you've got magnetite or hematite if you are not above 69.2% Fe, because it's an ambiguous solution. And you end up going down the path of normative mineralogy, how good you are at normative mineralogy and how in disequilibrium your ore deposit is going to be very interesting. Again, that's probably another hour and a half discussion on the ins and outs pain of trying to calculate a normative mineralogy from assays. Nonetheless, if you really want to do very good magnetite quantification, really none of those handheld systems are going to be really good enough for what you want, just because it's going to be unlikely that you're going to hit them. And even if you do hit them, it might be a little bit ambiguous. The spot size issue is actually important, particularly between LIBS and, say, XRF for the elemental methods, because with LIBS, maybe the really small spot size is actually what you want, right? So you want to be able to target that one little grain and give it a shoot and see that it comes back as magnetite. XRF's probably a little bit less good in this scenario. So moving down or moving up the level of quality is, then you say, let's just look at photos. And if magnetite's your only dark mineral, let's just threshold it, right? And just do whatever thresholding algorithm you like until it works. That'll give you a pretty decent quantitative point count of how much magnetite you've got or other dark things. So maybe that is good enough. But obviously, when you go down the path of photos, it does get really interesting doing the whole depth registration issue. Do you want to just deal with it in trays? Do you want to send it off to some third party to do their core scanning and chopping and changing and whatever else? If you are going down that path, there are a lot of providers these days. I don't know if any one of them are any better than anyone else, because I'm pretty sure they're all like COTS. So that's commercial off-the-shelf systems, because everybody's using the same code coming out of Google or Facebook for that type of image processing. So once we step past photography, then it's really into core scanners. And then it is, do I want to go hyperspectral imaging? Do I want to go LIBS imaging? Do I want to go XRF core scanning? Do I want to go point scanning of hyperspectral? How deep into the infrared do I want to go? Do I want to stop at 2500? Do I want to go a little bit further into the thermal? Where do I want to be? There's so many really interesting questions to ask yourself, and a lot of them are actually based on, what does my rock look like? Am I going to really pick up that magnetite grain? What's the size of the grain? If it's really small, you're almost going to have to go either LIBS as a point method or hyperspectral imaging, or LIBS imaging and hyperspectral imaging. Choosing a sensor system is always difficult, because you really need to understand what you're doing.
That was a really good explanation of the scalability of what you're looking for. Magnetite was a hard one, just because it's just so obvious to the naked eye. But you make a really good point of why it could be important also to go down the route of these different, especially some of these geophysical methods, to get a more quantitative answer.
Yeah, it's one of my other barrows to push, which is that you hard rock people should probably do more downhole geophysics. But
all the projects I'm currently working on are using downhole geophysics. So,
oh, that's very good.
Whatever.
Well, yeah.
But agreed. Yeah. No, this is heard, but that's not my hill to die on. I'll stick with the geochemistry. It's hard enough over here. So we talked about selecting our sensor type and kind of some of the decision points that go into there. But once we get there, how are we going to sort out companies that are providing a really scientifically sound product from those that are selling poor quality data masquerading as good data?
I'm going to preface everything I say here with, most people aren't that bad, and it's more sort of annoyances, because it's really hard to sell something that just absolutely doesn't work, right? What you will find is that maybe some of the things that should have been done, particularly around QAQC and data verification, might not have actually been done. So you're going to have to go back and either get them to rectify, you're going to have to rectify it yourself. Sat in on a lot of meetings around people trying to sell me stuff, which is always interesting, because you never go in blind to one of these meetings. So if someone's going to come in and sell you some XRF, so you go, okay, what is XRF? How does it work? What elements does it measure? What elements do I have, and do I care about? Is there an intersection between what they're telling me they measure and what I actually have and care about? That's always a good idea. But also, I find openness with people selling your stuff is very important. In particular, I can understand that they don't want to give away all their secrets, right? Because they do need some. And I'm sure they have some very nice IP that they don't talk about, because that's the best way to keep stuff secret, is just not to tell people what you're doing. But I don't think necessarily a lot of these things are as unique as they all say. If you look at something like, everybody's going to be doing convex hulls. You don't have to, but you probably should. Everybody's going to be doing a lot of the stuff that Clark spoke about, the convex hull, the shoulderness, the peak depths. Because particularly if you look at imaging, you end up with a lot of data points. So processing them with, say, something like Gaussian, or Gaussian fitting, is a very slow and expensive process. So most people are likely to be doing something that's some combination of band ratios, a bit of polynomial fitting here and there, shoulderness, convex hulls, and all of that. There's not a lot of really unique processing, unless you're doing something that's self-supervised. And I'm not necessarily even convinced that works yet. I haven't really tried a lot, but people are Lego piecing stuff together, because on the whole, most geologists aren't working for Facebook or Google. So they're probably not inventing things like XGBoost and chat. And I guess the other thing is, when they come in, they'll always have some level of case studies. It's just ask them about what their metrics are. You know, you say you achieve this percent accuracy in this geological environment, and it's not at all like my geological environment. What do you reasonably expect that you can achieve? How do you deal with differences between instruments? Because every instrument is very subtly different, right? You can ignore it. You can overfit to an individual instrument. You can globally fit to all your instruments. And just a lot of the stuff's around, what's my signal-to-noise ratio? What's my spectral resolution? And make sure they can tell you the difference between spectral resolution, very different to the spacing between bands that they report. They are not the same thing.
Indeed. Those are some really good points and some things to follow up with the, especially in a meeting when you have a provider that's trying to sell you their particular technology and just trying to make sure that they know all the terminology, I think is probably the first step. Because if you can't explain this, then what, do you not care enough to have somebody in on the meeting that can explain it to me? Or do you actually just not know the parameters of this system or what these terms mean? I've been shocked since being out in the wild for the last few years about some of these things. You have mentioned QA/QC before, and I think it's important that we talk about this, particularly with sensors, because I've come across quite a number of vendors that don't really subscribe to the concept of QA/QC. As we know, it's pretty well established in geochemistry programs, which is probably why, particularly on this podcast, we want to just be like, can we talk about this? But honestly, it's, like I said, it's still a big question mark here with sensor technologies to, one, understand what exactly a provider is doing internally, and what can mining companies do to reassure themselves that they're getting the best quality data?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first thing you need to assess for yourself is, do they have a surface method? This is probably the most important question, because if it is a surface technique, are you affected by muds? Which muds are you affected by? Drilling fluids? Drilling fluids ain't fluids. There's a lot of different types of fluids out there. Some may or may not have a thick enough film that remain on the core to cause you problems. And it's actually really hard to get the fluid composition from the fluid manufacturers. I have tried to do this and they have never given me a good answer. Like, you have to say things like, does your fluid contain chlorine? And then they say yes or no. But it is something to be aware of. So if you have certain methods that are sensitive to certain elements, you need to be aware if you have fluids in them, let's say chlorine, I don't know, I'll just pick something. Let's say it's chlorine and your, I don't know, libs, for the sake of argument. Libs is really sensitive to chlorine and really stuffs everything up. I don't know, I made that up, it's probably not true. But for the sake of argument, that's what happens. If you've got chlorine in your drilling fluid, buggers everything up. That's very important to know if you are doing surface techniques, because when the drillers stop using that fluid because they won't run the fluids all the time, you're going to have all these apparent changes in your geology that don't actually really exist. Question one, just, and other things again, particularly probably because this is targeted really at core imaging more than anything. Do you have oriented core? How do you handle it? What's your depth registration? This is actually probably the most important question. Is it fully automatic? Is it manual? Do you check it? Does the software ensure that you can't have core overlaps in depth? How do you deal with instrument drift? With instruments, there's two parts of your QA/QC. One is your instrumental drift, right? So that is, if I have an instrument, how much does that intrinsically change? If you've got hyperspectral, I'll go and scan. And another little rage point of mine, for God's sakes, please stop scanning test rocks in hyperspectral. It's just madness. But yeah, hyperspectral, you scan your dope spectralon and your mylar and you check your peaks, and they all exist in the same place and they haven't drifted, and they haven't drifted too much. Do you correct for that drift? Because that's important. You could have a lot of channels of drift, but you could correct it every time the drift is irrelevant. Is your spectrum, is it an absolute calibration? Is your 1200 nanometers exactly 1200 nanometers, or is it just channel 120? So if you looked at, if they provided two instruments for you, that 1200 nanometers might be channel 121. And this is, comes back again to the internal reference checks for the actual instrument. And do you cross-validate between instruments? One of the interesting facts about dope spectralon is that they're actually quite inconsistent. you've probably seen it. So if you look at one panel of dope Spectralon and another panel of dope Spectralon, they don't really look the same at all. So how does the person extract the features out of the dope Spectralon, or do they just overlay the Spectralons on top of each other? Because if they're from different batches, they're not going to be the same at all. Do you deal with drift? Can you correct the systems? Yeah, just things like software versions. As people develop stuff, they get it better over time. How do you manage that version that you've sent to me? So if you process something for me today, and then you reprocess it again tomorrow, do I get the same result if it's the same software version? Is there any changes? Do you inform me that they've changed? If I have a really long running program and it runs for a year, and you make an improvement somewhere in the middle of the project, how do I know that I'm getting consistent results? Or do you have to reprocess everything for me? Because that's something that will absolutely trip you up, particularly if you're looking at it and it's a very subtle change and you're trying to go and do a geological interp and you go, oh, this is, maybe it's a fault because it jumps up here or something. And converting spectra to results, because you can't model spectrum, to my great disappointment. How much training data do you need? Do you actually need training data, or are you just going to give me best interps, right? These are all the things that are very important around QAQC. And particularly, there's other things like if you're using press pulp standards and they got a lot of sulfide in them or something that degrades over time, you need to be checking them to make sure that they're those internal standards. So if you've got a press pulp standard and it's got a lot of sulfide, what's going to degrade over time, right? Things will change. Do they calibrate to that standard and assume the standard is the same? So then you have an internal drift in your system, or do they have a different standard that actually is used to monitor the instrument? So the stainless steel disc monitors the instrument state, and then the whatever it is, the press pulp standard just tells you something. And those are the really important things for QAQC that I would deal with. And that's not touching on your stuff from your side. Have I called it the same whole name, for example? Does it go in a database?
I think you make really great points. I think the only thing that mining companies have been able to do to have a degree over of control over things is to, when you talk about submitting your own samples, which is to be really what I would consider more of a field duplicate. So it's not doing anything that going to impact how the system is operating or how you're monitoring drift, et cetera, but what it is just saying, okay, we're scanning this, whether it's a pulp for the XRF or it is a some core for a hyperspectral scanning system, we're scanning this and we're just expecting it to look the same every single time. And that's really, to my knowledge, just the best way that mining companies can feel their own degree of control. But as a duplicate, it's not going to be impacting anything that the vendor is doing. So it's still important to really understand all the controls that you've talked about, drift, about standards, et cetera, because I've encountered companies that only, even though they've been at market for a while, only now are developing their QAQC programs, which is crazy. How are you calibrating? How are you monitoring drift? Their answer was that they weren't, which was not great.
I guess the QAQC of instruments is a non-trivial exercise and is very difficult to manage if you're external to the process. So if you ring up your service provider and you say, send me all your QAQC protocols, in theory, they should just say, sure, here are all of our QAQC protocols.
Yeah.
But they may not have any. But look,
or you could be developing them in tandem with them as some kind of crazy exercise that you're like, this is unreal. But yeah,
just for lols. Yeah, but again, back to it.
Also, one thing that I will say to think about with instrument drift is it's also really important the environment that you're in, because so I do some work out in the desert and we think, oh, okay, the instrument could be out of spec because it gets really hot during the daytime, but actually it also gets very cold during the nighttime. So you just have to make sure that also whatever the scanning system is being housed in is controlled to the elements to a degree as well. That's why things that are put in boxes can be much better in a sense, because you understand that they're heated and cooled to the instrument specifications. So that's just another thing that people should be thinking about, because drift is a big problem. Instruments always must be in spec.
Yeah, and they're even some instruments just drift intrinsically much more than other. Well, certain sensor types in the really lanthanum bromide, sodium iodide, CCDs, and etc. Some of those drift much more than other things as well. Pointless.
Yeah, know your instruments. Yeah.
Yeah, know your instruments. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, know your instruments. It's easy to know your instruments, but know them.
All right, yeah, go spend 6 hours on the Hamamatsu website just
yes.
checking out detectors.
Yeah, find an academic to bother. No, they always want to talk.
No, don't bother them. Go email Hamamatsu directly.
So we've talked about data collection, but what of data processing? And I think we actually talked a little bit about it just before, but in the sense of, say, with Spectra, right? How do we go from, say, spectral counts to PPMs in XRF system, or from digital numbers to radiance, reflectance, to minerals and hyperspectral? Do all the companies do the same thing? And it also, is it a bad thing if they don't do the same thing?
Oh, look, to be honest, I don't know what most companies do, or any really. I just know what I do. And I just know that there's not that many different options. And it's also very dependent on the spectra you have. If you've got really peaky spectra, so you just imagine you've got basically a dead flat line and there's a peak and nothing else that touches it, you might just want to say, give me the sum between that channel and that channel that gives me the whole area under the peak, and do that for however many other peaks you've got. Sum them up and divide them by some other peak and regress A against B. That is a perfectly legitimate way to do it. A lot of people will just go PLS, particularly if you're looking at calibrating something against something else. Then there's the whole feature extraction, band ratios, and everything under the sun. There's so many options, honestly. It doesn't really matter what they do. There are the only real useful guideline that I can give you is that if you do not have a lot of data, be very wary of overfitting, and particular people doing very fancy methods with very little data. If you have 100 data points or even 1,000, PLS, please do not use convolutional neural networks, don't use neural networks, don't use XGBoost, don't use any tree-based methods, just use PLS, because you just do not have the data to support that level of regression tool, right? You just don't. And this is a very particular, I have a target parameter that I want to predict everywhere, and I want to upscale that from my spectra. You really have to simplify your processing down in terms of that. You could do a whole heap of self-supervised stuff. People have proposed things like autoencoders to, I just get my spectra and I train a model to recognize it and decompose it into different clusters. There's things like image analysis. You can do SWAV. SWAV's a cool paper. You should read it. But there's just so many different methods. None of them necessarily are good or bad. It's just whether it's appropriate for the data you have is really where you're going to have a lot of problems. And I know people love fancy stuff, but I really think you should generally be avoiding it.
And then the only thing I would add to that is that I respect the fact that there is IP for every company, but at the same time, if your provider can't give you a broad overview with some details of what they're doing, then I would be skeptical, because like you've said before, there's not too much out there that hasn't already been done, right? Like there are many variations on it, but you're following some pretty set guidelines pretty much for how to pre-process data and then how to convert, say, an XRF to count, to convert from counts to PPM, for example.
Oh, XRF is even more constrained than that, because it is a very well-known process, right?
Exactly. But if your provider can't explain to you the process in there, then that's where you should have a lot of questions as to whether this vendor is correct for you. Yeah. And I think that goes for all sensors. I think if there's not that degree of openness of what is going on generally, then it's a little bit dubious to me.
Yeah, and there's nothing stopping you from doing any of the methods yourself, generally speaking. You can try it. If you Ozscope. If I'm going to put a plug in, Sam, I'm going to put a plug in for Ozscope. They have so much hyperspectral data, basically don't know what to do with yourself. But so long as you can actually go to Ozscope, you can try any of these methods like spectral angle mapper. You can just go and do that if you wanted to, or you can just try and do some band ratios if you wanted to. There's nothing, again, nothing stopping you from opening up TSG and just processing the data yourself. It's not the end of the world. You just click on it, the file opens.
Moving forward, what do you think the largest disconnects are out there between service providers and mining companies?
Ah, yes. Now, I'm going to get in so much trouble for saying this, but anyway, I'll do it anyway. The biggest issue I find is that service providers are pretty much HD, university, and they go into service provision. That seems to be the general path for a lot of these core scanning companies. They go from a idea in a university and they get spun out. And then they go, what are we going to use this for? Mining, tick, makes a lot of money, tick, let's go sell there. I think the biggest problem with that is that there's a real disconnect between what you require as business versus what somebody is going to provide you as an academic. And it all comes back to, when do I want something? Actually, do I want the best possible answer, or do I just want an answer in a week that's okay? The kind of okay answers are actually quite good. Does it get me above the hurdle? Because you remember, if I'm in a greenfields project and I've never done any core scanning before, anything you do by the definition is probably the best work that's ever been done on that project. And then, yeah, just that disconnect between, again, why am I scanning the core? What do I want out of it? I think for exploration, it's a little bit more obvious. So people go, I want to find an ore deposit. That's quite straightforward. It's just when you go to mining and or your brownfield, you are getting a core scanner in to do a specific job and you know exactly what you want. You just don't know how to get it, right? So you send your core to the service provider. They do some magic and then they throw it back over the fence and you go, okay, great, what am I going to do with this now? I guess I'll just take an average across my composite interval and then I could have just done hyperspectral on pulps and been happy.
Oh my God, you're not wrong. I think one of the large reasons that I finally decided to do my own company was that I had this exact problem, which was that we were delivering all this mineralogical information and I was like, just watching all these great interps die because there was just this disconnect between, okay, how do we integrate this into our program and integrate it also with other data sets and then implement an actual solution to all this. And I just saw a really big opportunity there that was just being missed. So you are not wrong.
Oh, look, I think even it's because there's not a lot of people have experience processing spectra and working for a mining company. Mm. So when I did my former principal data scientist job and I processed a lot of spectra, people would complain to me and I would fix their problems. But I understood what their problems were because I was probably looking at the exact same problem going, is this good enough? How could I make this better? Who's the downstream customer of this? Do they even need it? Who needs it? What's my time? When do you need it? What's the time frame we need to be operating in? And just understanding mining, understanding exploration, that's the real disconnect I find between the service providers. So probably if there's any service providers or mining companies listening, which probably, I don't know, it's just me talking into the void, it might behoove you to somehow have some sort of system where somebody comes and works in your business and does some stuff and learns about things that you're doing so they could take it back to the service provider to give you a better service. And I don't even know if you want to do that because there's IP issues. And how much information do you want to tell your service provider who will just go and sell it to the next person, which I think is always where this type of stuff falls over.
I think I saw a lot of linkages between mining companies being pretty open with service providers. So I think that openness is there. It's also a lot of times you're working with these technical teams that are sitting up in their head office in Perth and Toronto and Vancouver, wherever, but they're not necessarily the people that are really using it and using the and applying the data in a daily way, say. And so there's also the disconnect between all the different levels of the mining company and the service writing company. And so it's just this more complex issue that, yeah, No easy answer, I suppose, but well, I think no, you proposed not. A few I things.
Mean, when I used to do it and people would bring me up and complain and I'd fix their problems, like people from site would call me and I would talk to site 3 or 4 times a day sometimes, and I'd call them and all the operators would call me operating the instruments, or the fieldies would call me who were organizing stuff. So I actually spoke to nearly everybody on site. So I had a decent understanding of the magic and not magic that happened. So yeah, it was always very interesting that the amount of just contrast between what I knew was happening versus even the service providers onwards. They're just so far apart from operational reality.
So then another thing that we see with these scanning systems is that they produce quite a bit of data. And so a lot of times still we hear in conferences, we hear from people that there's too much data. So how do we go about really rectifying this age-old complaint that there's too much data? And how could we possibly integrate this into programs? Because there's too much data, there's no point in even collecting it.
One, they do collect too much data. That's obvious. Two, nobody really mines with a teaspoon, or they don't even mine with a needle in some cases, because they are really quite small spot sizes. But I guess that's not actually the point. They do collect a lot of data. That is the whole double-edged sword, as it were, of that process. For some things, you really want that very high-resolution data, because the big advantage of having so much data is upscaling. Let's say, and probably goes again back to GeoMet, it's all about upscaling. So I've got my Met composites, and I do some magical processing, and magic happens. How do I identify from those 10, 20, 100 Met composites which one was good and bad? Why are they different? Having a lot of data in that sense is really great. So I can say, look at the distribution of these minerals, and they ran through the processing circuit and I got this result. Look at then how can I upscale. The only problem really about having too much data is that it's the inconsistency between the core scanning and this particularly core. How do I apply all that knowledge from the scanned core to the rest of my data set? And this, if you go back to Amira P843, and I actually had to Google this because I think it's quite amazing. They've got this pyramid where they say, we've got all our assays on the bottom, and then I can't remember the two things that sit in the middle. I should probably click on the link that I put in there. But basically at the top, they've got the GeoMet data, and you're trying to predict from that very small amount of data to the rest of your ore body. So if I've got core scanning, and I take all these points on this very small amount of drill holes, how do I propagate all of that learning to the rest of my data set? And that, I feel, really is where the scanners fall over. Because even if you look at something simple like XRF, and I've got a XRF core scan, and I've got an assay for an interval, if you look at the similarity between the XRF for a core, an XRF core scan and an assay core scan, an assay XRF result, they do not give you the same result, right? So if you were to generate a model from the XRF core scan and apply that to your assay data, your model doesn't work. Falls over.
Sometimes even they're using your assay data to go from counts to PPM. So actually, if you're going to do any kind of deeper learning with an XRF scanning system, I would actually just recommend to use the counts in general.
I would actually just use the assays, but
yeah, it actually.
Yeah, but this comes down to a very interesting comment around assay labs in general. The classic is iron ore, and I love iron ore, best commodity, as they all say. If you look at if you do a Met model for iron ore, and you look at, say, the big five: iron, phos, LOI, silica, alumina, and you make a model with those, because they're monitored really well at the labs, you can actually, generally speaking, apply that model everywhere and not have any issues. If you start including your miners like calcium, magnesium, potassium, and so on, the distribution of all of those elements is not the same between labs. Your model does not work as well as you think it does, and it falls over in interesting ways that you won't necessarily realize, right? It's very subtle. You need to be very careful when you're doing modeling like this, that you're distributions of data and the relationship between all your analytes is actually the same. For God's sakes, just send all your assays to one lab. You probably shouldn't. There you go.
Yeah, we all know about the consistency in assaying, and you can have an empire lab, but otherwise, same package. But historic data sets get really complicated. This is not what we're talking about today. Oh, it's everybody's headache. All right, so for my last question, and coming back to the paper that we read about, where they talked about characterizing ore properties for a geomet program, now looking back after everything that we talked about, how would you design a program like this from the initial questions that you're asking to building out data collection and finally integrating these data sets to produce a high impact solution?
Firstly, I would just, I've got a link, I've sent it, you should probably stick it in there. It's very good. It's from GTK.
Yeah.
Simon Michaud. I don't know. Sorry, Simon, if I've said your name wrong. So that is a very good overview. Probably just read the whole document and do that. But if you wanted a really tasty takeaway, it would be just everything is going to have to go back to assays in the end. Look at your distribution of the data that you have in your ore body, because you've probably been there for 10 years, right, at the point you're doing geomet. Look back and see, one, do I still have pulp packets? If you've got your pulps or some historical data that you can re-assay, maybe keep that in your back pocket, because that's something you can actually deal with and potentially re-assay to get better performance. Talking about core scanning, one of the better uses of core scanning in general is just that upscaling of metallurgical predictions, right? So if I've got all this data for an interval and I generate a met prediction, I can use my core scanning data to upscale that prediction to the whole hole and then to similar holes or adjacent holes, and just to see, am I getting a pure metallurgical sample? Do I have any discontinuities down the profile, right? So if I train a model on my previous phases and I've got a new phase and I apply that to my new data, do I have discontinuities? Where would I want to collect it? Do I want a really pure met sample? Do I have two distributions that are not the same? Obviously, I'll take one here and one here and make sure I don't take a sample across the boundary. And I feel like that is the biggest advantage of core scanning, is that real ability to upscale just your met properties across a 10 centimeter, 20 centimeter meter scale across your drill hole. Take a good sample. Yeah, and again, everything's going back to assays. So if you don't have good assays, you should probably just get some good assays, because you're going to have to model that met property across your entire deposit somehow. You could take one sample and take an average, and that's probably fine too.
I want to thank you so much for being here, Ben, and I hope that this discussion has given geos out there some things to think about when trying to integrate sensor technology into their toolkit. I want to thank everybody for listening to Geochemistry, and a big thanks to Ben Chai for being on the show, dishing some tea and taking us on this journey. Thanks to our sponsor, LKI Consulting, and to It's Water and Coma Media for our music. And I'm looking forward to chatting with everyone next month.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.